We all know unfettered misinformation about hate flow from today's social media. But in recent months, Facebook and Twitter have repeatedly claimed to be working hard to flag COVID lies and bigotry-laden screeds. So how are they doing? Terribly, according to my next guest, who heads up the increasingly essential Center for Countering Digital Hate. His recent New York Times column said as much, and I am grateful to be joined right now by Imran Ahmed. Imran, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
So your latest research focuses on anti-Semitism. What commitments from the social media giants were you checking up on?
Well, look, we know that anti-Semitism is one of the oldest, most pernicious forms of racism. It's a cancer that, if you allow it into your society, can metastasize easily and can reconstitute itself. And we have done a lot of work in our societies over the past few years, you know, past decades, centuries, in fact, to make sure that Jewish people feel safe and that they are able to participate fully in public life and public discourse. One of the ways in which anti-Semitism has found a foothold in our society is that it's found social media to be a particularly amenable place to them spreading the rhetoric, the misinformation, the conspiracy theories that underpin hatred of Jews. And so that's why we looked at the commitments made by social media platforms, which say that not only do they ban anti-Semitism on their platforms, but also they ban the precursors to anti-Semitism, Holocaust denial, dehumanizing rhetoric. And we wanted to have a look at their how they really dealt with it. So look, my great contention is that the true measure of morality is not what you say you will do in public. It's what you do in private when you think no one is looking. Mm-hmm. And what we did was we reported 715 bits of hardcore anti-Semitism, the kind of stuff that would offend you if you saw it immediately. And we then went back and saw what action was taken by those platforms against that content. Well, you know, social media companies, tech people, they love numbers. They love statistics. I can now put a number on how much they care about anti-Semitism, 16%, because that's how much of the anti-Semitism that we identified they actually took down.
When you looked at what you found, were you surprised by any of it?
It's hard to surprise me. You know, we do work on the proliferation of Islamic State terrorist narratives of misinformation that might lead to people dying because they get information about their health vaccines that's wrong. So I wasn't surprised, but I was disgusted. For me, this is not a technological question because this is a moral question. Do you have the will to act on hate when you see it? And we took out all the algorithm questions because, of course, we reported it to them. We handed them the anti-Semitism on a silver platter and said, do with it as you wish. And they cared, exactly 16%.
Where else do you see religion get dragged into online hate and or misinformation campaigns?
We see religion as something... It is a reflection, of course, of offline religious intolerance. And there is religious intolerance of all kinds towards all religions in different parts of the world and among different communities. So there is anti-Muslim hatred in parts of Europe, in the US, in other parts of the world. There's anti-Jewish hatred. There's anti-Christian hatred. Faith groups find themselves under attack all over the world. And it's really important that we don't allow the world's most powerful communications platforms to become vectors for intolerance, because their power is more than any other form of communication. They have a direct line into our lives in a way that a newspaper doesn't. When you pick up a newspaper, you're picking up something and you're in a critical frame of mind. When you're watching the news, you're thinking, you know, what do I think about this? When you're consuming social media, you're looking at pictures of, you know, for me, my siblings and their children, the people I love in the world. Occasionally, I admit, cat gifts because I find cats amusing, and then of course some misinformation that's designed to proselytize hatred to me. And we're not in that same frame of that critical frame of mind, so that's why they're such powerful platforms. What can the end effect be? Well, think about the fact that in the past few years there has been at least one genocide in which the hatred of Muslims in of the Rohingya Muslims was actually inculcated and then operationalized and turned into an active genocide aside on a social media platform, on Facebook quite specifically.
Talk to us about maybe four or five or however many you want of the most dishonestly presented to social media issues.
Well look, I think that we have a particular problem with hate on social media platforms that has really been ineffectively dealt with over a long period of time. And the companies have been through an evolution on how they dealt with hate. Initially, they said it isn't our problem. Society is racist or religiously intolerant. It's our platforms are just a reflection of that. Increasingly, they've come to an awareness that if you are the vector, if you are the means by which hate is spread, that you hold some moral responsibility. But the issue for all of us who are campaigning for more tolerant societies in which people are able to pursue their faith and their relationship with God or whoever, whatever it is that they believe in safety and in a way that is not driven by fear, but instead by their desire for self-actualization, for understanding, then to do that, we need to reduce the prevalence, the fear of hatred that people feel. And the social media companies have accepted that they have a role to play in it. And when you've got 3.5 billion users and you're worth $100 billion because you sell the data those people give you to advertisers, I think they've started to accept that they have a moral responsibility. However, they haven't followed through on it. And In American law, the regulation that surrounds social media companies is called Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act 1996. So the regulation's 25 years old, before social media was invented even. And that law is actually called the Good Samaritan Law because it says that you aren't liable for any harm that's created on your platform, but you also have absolute protection from any moderate decisions you take to clean your platform as you wish. So you, in fact, the platforms have an absolute fundamental right to moderate their platforms, to take people off their platforms who are causing harm. And they're protected under US law from doing it. So this is the Good Samaritan law. The issue is that this is not a Good Samaritan that we're dealing with. These are greedy, venal, lazy companies who know that hate actually drives attention and engagement. They prey on the worst bits of our instincts and also the best bits as well. So they prey on those people who want to hate. They know they're safe on social media platforms. It's a safe space for racist and religiously intolerant people. And then for those of us who argue against them, it knows that we are, as human beings, we have a fight or flight reaction. So we respond to malignant behavior. And all of that means eyeballs, engagement, controversy, loads and loads of people watching. And what are they doing while they're watching the hatred unfurl in our society? Consuming advertising. 98% of Facebook's revenue comes from advertising. And that, unfortunately, has created a sort of a pernicious cycle, a vicious cycle in which they generate more controversy for more profits. That tells their algorithms that people like controversy, so it feeds us more and more and more. And we've got companies which theoretically could do so much good to spread good information, to bring communities together, to allow people to network and find inspiration from other faiths, from other people, from other societies, and yet have been turned into machines for delivery of polarization, of vociferous narratives, of polarizing narratives that make us more brittle as a society. It's time for us to look at that and say, well, look, the economic incentives in this are all wrong, and we need to fix those. And the way to fix them is to regulate. That's what we did with, say, you know, climate change and oil, or with tobacco and the diseases that are caused by tobacco, and it can kill you. And we then regulated around it. The same is true of social media, that we're going to need to make sure that there is a cost to be paid for not being the good Samaritan that the US law allows you to be, to incentivize good behavior and disincentivize bad behavior. And I think that given what happened in the past year, where misinformation has worsened a pandemic, but also led to people who now say, I was led down the garden path, committing acts of domestic terrorism in the country that, you know, I live up the road from the capital. It was horrifying, that when we see Jews feeling that they can't post on social media, that they feel they're being pushed out of public life, I know that there are historical analogies within living memory for where that leads. And I think it's time for us to change the system, because otherwise it can lead to terrible things very quickly.
You know, I remember a few years ago there were reports that a growing number of Americans rely on social media for their news and understanding of the world, which was an immensely worrying trend. In light of your work and other reports demonstrating how false much of what is posted actually is, do you see that blind trust being reduced at all, or are we still very vulnerable?
To understand social media is to understand that this is not like drinking from a tap. It's not water that you know is being regulated, is being cleaned, that this is like drinking from a stream and you don't know who's put what inside there. And so social media, you have to be cautious when you drink from that knowledge stream, and be aware that it may have been poisoned by foreign actors, by domestic enemies, by people who just do it because it amuses them. And to be very aware that you're unsafe in that moment, and to take precautions. And I think there are going to be three parts to how we fix this problem of social media, which has so many good aspects to it, too, that we're going to have education so people understand that when they drink from those waters, they may be tainted. The second is that we're going to have sensible regulation that doesn't cripple this industry that is so economically powerful, viable, and is a strength for the United States and, you know, my home country, the United Kingdom as well, which is a leading nation in artificial intelligence that underpins these platforms, so that we have sensible regulation. And then also we're going to need to have some self-regulation by these companies. And I think a new generation of leaders will have to come forwards at those companies that understand that they have a responsibility to more than just their checkbooks, right?
This is a critically important topic. Would you tell our listeners how they can learn more about your research and to keep on the work of the center?
Our website is www.counterhate.com. People should have a look at our content there, subscribe to get updates, and to support it where you can. I mean, we're very young as an organization. We're actually turning two in a month. So we haven't really ever thought through things like fundraising and other things before. But please, in the meantime, just your support when you talk to other people, and to look at some of the things that we've written, like Don't Feed the Trolls, and think about the role that you can play as an individual in educating others about both the positives of social media, the dangers, and also what we should be doing as individuals to make sure we don't become part of the problems ourselves.
Imrod Ahmed is the CEO of the Center for Countering Digital Hate, an immense undertaking that is immensely important. Follow the work at the center at counterhate.com. Imran, thank you so much for being with us today, and you're always welcome at State of Belief Radio.
It was such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.